I'm John Dennis. It's Tuesday the 14th of July. Today, a new poll shows support for scrapping Trident. And it's good news for David Cameron, even though voters say he should sack his top spin doctor.
60-65% of people think Coulson should leave, even a majority of Tories, or at least more Tories think he should go than should stay. So he's certainly not popular.
Also today, Ian Duncan Smith, the Tory leader turned Tory thinker on social affairs, tells Polly Toynbee what he thinks the government should do for families.
Counselling and guidance, properly applied, can reap phenomenal dividends in stabilising relationships and helping people stay together.
And Nadia Clark, a bright but severely disabled girl whose parents fought to get her educated in mainstream schools, is now 17. How does she get on?
Nadia is very much of an individual. Her personality shines through when you meet her.
But first, Bill Overton's here. He's got the news.
Tests will be carried out later to find out whether a GP and a six-year-old girl who've died after contracting swine flu had any underlying health problems. Their deaths take the number in the UK that are linked to the virus to 17. Dr. Michael Day, a family doctor from Bedfordshire, died on Saturday, and Chloe Buckley from Northwest London died on Thursday at St Mary's Hospital in Paddington. The first British patient to die of swine flu without having further health problems died on Friday in Essex. The UK has almost 10,000 confirmed cases, which is the third highest number worldwide after the US and Mexico. Gordon Brown's asked the Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, to send more Afghan troops into Helmand province to reinforce the British fight against the Taliban. The Prime Minister's told the House of Commons the army needs support in holding land taken during recent offensives. He was facing calls to send more troops and equipment to Afghanistan after 8 soldiers were killed there in 24 hours. In the United States, pressure's growing for an investigation into new disclosures that a secret CIA program to capture or kill al-Qaeda leaders was concealed from Congress for 8 years, possibly by Vice President Dick Cheney. The program, which never got off the ground, was designed to target leaders of the terrorism network at close range, rather than with airstrikes that risk civilian casualties. The program was cancelled last month by CIA Director Leon Panetta, shortly after he himself first learned of it. The Real IRA has been blamed by Sinn Féin for trouble in North Belfast. At least one shot was fired at police by Republicans, and there were other disturbances after Orange Order parades. 13 police officers were hurt across Northern Ireland, and baton rounds and water cannon were used. Violence in the Ardoyne area of Belfast continued into Monday night, with petrol bombs, fireworks, stones and bottles thrown at police after they tried to divert rioters away from a parade route. 3 vans were also hijacked and 2 of them were pushed at police lines. In today's sport, Manchester City have agreed a deal to sign former West Ham and Manchester United striker Carlos Tevez. The 25-year-old Argentine forward, who left Old Trafford last month, will sign a 5-year deal subject to a medical. And Steve Harmison's been named in a 14-man England squad for the second test against Australia at Lord's as cover for the injured Andrew Flintoff. Now for a look at today's papers. A sore throat and 48 hours later, Chloe was dead. That's the way the Mail reports the death of what's thought to be Britain's latest swine flu victim. The paper says she's the first healthy child to die of the virus, a claim also repeated on the front page of the Daily Telegraph and The Sun. The papers add that a Bedfordshire GP who died over the weekend, 64-year-old Michael Day, was also previously healthy. However, the BBC and The Guardian report more tests are needed to determine whether the H1N1 virus was the only cause of death. The Guardian also features a poll looking at attitudes to Britain's nuclear weapons. The ICM Guardian poll suggests 54% of all voters would prefer to abandon nuclear weapons rather than put money into a new generation of Trident warheads. Last week's G8 summit brought suggestions that Britain might include Trident in international disarmament talks. The Independent has news of what it describes as a landmark ruling by the Charity Commission, which will force private schools to take in more pupils from poorer backgrounds. The watchdog's investigating schools and has so far found 2 that it says are failing to meet tough new standards for retaining charitable status. And in The Express, there's news of a wonder pill that could halve body fat in just a week. It's only been tested on mice so far, but the paper quotes a US scientist saying the research proves it is safe to reduce body weight so drastically. For constantly updated news and sport throughout the day, go to guardian.co.uk.
A new Guardian ICM poll today shows the Conservatives extending their lead over Labour as the parties exchange blows over public spending. Our chief leader writer, Julian Glover, has been crunching the numbers.
The Guardian looks at sort of popular opinion every month. We've been tracking it. Labour is on 27%, which is pretty bad. They're stuck back where they've been for the last 3 or 4 months in Guardian polls. Tories are now on 41%. That's a bit up for them. They'll be very happy to be above 40. They haven't really been above 40 in any poll since the expenses crisis. Not a great lead, but 14-point lead is pretty solid. Lib Dems on 20%, and they'll be happy with that.
One thing which we've heard the parties arguing about again and again, and we'll continue to do so until the election and beyond, is spending. Now, how is that sort of playing itself out in public opinion?
Well, this is one of those issues that's dominated politics at Westminster. Over the last week or so, we've had people talk about Afghanistan and Andy Coulson and things. So it's gone out of the news for the last few days, but I think it's about to come back. What it shows is that Gordon Brown is losing the battle on spending. There's a debate inside Labour. There's a debate inside the Tories. Should people boast about cuts, say they're really going to be tough in government, or should they kind of hide what they're planning to do? Labour has emphasised investment. They've said if you vote Labour, you'll get spending, you'll get good services. Tories say we can't afford it. There's no money. If you vote Tory, you'll get cuts. The poll shows public back cuts. Almost twice as many people think there should be cuts as there should be increased spending at the moment. Even Labour voters, I think 55% of Labour voters think this is the moment for cuts. So Gordon Brown will be a bit worried by that.
Well, one of the big government projects that may face the axe is Trident nuclear programme. What do the public think about that?
Yes, we asked about Trident. It's a question various people have polled on, but normally when they've asked a polling question, they've asked, should we replace Trident or just keep nuclear weapons? This month we asked, should you replace Trident? We didn't mention the cost of it. That can sometimes distort the figure. Just said, should we replace it or should we get rid of nuclear weapons altogether? And for the first time, a majority of people in Britain want to scrap nuclear weapons. Even 40% of Tories think we should get rid of nuclear weapons, most Labour voters, most Lib Dems. So the mood has really shifted against Trident. And I guess there's two reasons for that. One is people don't see nuclear weapons as a way of defending themselves. It's not much use in Afghanistan. It's not much use against terrorism anywhere. They don't really fear Russia at the moment. The other is just the cost. I think people don't think we can afford Trident, and if they're looking for cuts, that's an obvious one to come for.
Now, the whole phone hacking scandal that The Guardian splashed with towards the end of last week, of course, does affect parties because Andy Coulson, the former editor of the News of the World, is David Cameron's director of communications. What do the public think about that?
Well, first of all, just given the Tory lead is extended, it clearly hasn't damaged Cameron too much. He'll be quite pleased to have gone up in the polls, not down in the polls, after all the coverage he got at the end of last week. But on Coulson himself, most people think he should go. How much they know about Coulson, of course, is open to question. But 60-65% of people think Coulson should leave. Even a majority of Tories, or at least more Tories, think he should go than should stay. So he's certainly not popular.
Julian Glover, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website today, a week in an old people's home. Amelia Gentleman writes at guardian.co.uk/society. George Monbiot has little hope for the Energy White paper being published tomorrow. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. And we've got an interview with Aidan Gillen, formerly of The Wire, now starring in the BBC One drama Feel For. That's at guardian.co.uk/culture. After he was toppled as leader of the Conservative Party, Ian Duncan Smith set up the Centre for Social Justice think tank. And it's produced a report this week designed to strengthen the institution of marriage. It says that couples with marital problems should have a cooling off period of 3 months before they can begin divorce proceedings. Duncan Smith was interviewed by The Guardian's columnist Polly Toynbee.
I don't think governments can dictate to people or tell people what to do, but I think governments can have a very clear look at what they're doing and ask whether it's negative or whether it's positive to what I call stable family formation. And that's all that we're looking at. And two very good examples of this. The first is, you know, we are alone in Western Europe in believing somehow that marriage is just another family formation, that it isn't relevant, it isn't important. Everybody else out there actually thinks that it's important enough to recognise and celebrate. So we are sort of slightly unique. We're also unique in this, that the level of our family breakup is phenomenal. It's way beyond anybody else in Western Europe. We have more families breaking up, we have more lone parents, we have more teenage pregnancies. If we're doing something right, I'd love to know what it was, because nobody else wants to copy us. Nobody should be beating a path to our door to find out how you stabilise
society. Our teenage pregnancies have been falling.
Come on, Polly, this is marginal rubbish. The truth is, we have an appalling record on all of this, and if I was any other country in Western Europe, I would ring-fence Britain and say, don't go there, avoid that like the plague, because that place teaches you how not to do things. We spend over 20 to 23 billion simply trying to support lone parents at the moment, but we don't spend anything at all worth talking about on getting ahead of the problem. One of the points we pointed out in Breakthrough Britain was each taxpayer pays about £800 per taxpayer for the post-breakup, but we spend less than 50 pence per taxpayer on the idea that somehow counselling and guidance, properly applied, can reap phenomenal dividends in stabilising relationships and helping people stay together. We don't think that's important. We are alone again in most of the civilised world in believing that getting ahead of the problem would enormously help matters. So we are talking here about rejigging that.
Give a lot more money to counselling, because services like Relate, who've often been strapped for money, but they say that they're not for keeping couples together, they're for making sure that couples make the right decisions. They're very anxious to say, we are not judgmental. If people want to separate, we will help them separate in a more amicable way. They don't badge themselves as being, we're married.
I don't think any organisation I've ever met that helps couples over their problems ever comes in, wags the finger and says, you're terrible people, because that would be rather pointless. All the organisations I've seen, beyond Relate as well, by the way, and in other countries, but here, a lot of the community and charitable groups that do this, they can be religious, they can be non-religious, they all pretty much approach it from the same standpoint, which is our job here is to try and figure out why you're talking about breaking up. Many of them say, most of the couples that come and see them have got a particular issue, but when they delve into it, it's not that issue that was the problem. In about 80% of the cases, it may be debt, for example, they track back to. And once they sort that out, then the whole system sorts itself out. So it's not about saying right or wrong. It's saying to them, look, for the sake of everybody, let's figure out whether this thing can be stabilised and saved. And that, by the way, in almost every one of the groups I've visited, and there are many more beyond Relate as well, they say that you can save up to about 50% of the relationships that come in front of you that otherwise would break up.
Ian Duncan Smith, and you can see a longer version of Polly's interview with him today at guardian.co.uk/video. I'm John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, do more for poorer children or don't call yourself a charity. That's the message to two independent schools today from the charities regulator.
All the indications are now that they're going to have to provide a serious chunk of bursaries to be allowed to keep their charitable status.
But first, about 30,000 people are members of organised crime gangs, and they're costing the country up to £40 billion a year. That's according to a Home Office report today. And with the details is our Home Affairs editor, Alan Travis.
It's a Cabinet Office Strategy Unit report, which we used to call the Delling Street Think Tank, which was commissioned to look at the performance of the Serious and Organised Crime Agency, which there's widespread concern about, 3 years old, and doesn't command huge respect amongst the police. Some of them refer to it as the Serious Disorganised Crime Agency. And so there's an effort inside government to try and improve its performance. It's come up with another analysis of the state of organised crime in Britain. It says that there are what it calls about 30,000 individuals involved in what it calls the long tail of organised crime in Britain. That can include anything from counterfeiting, selling pirate DVDs, to people trafficking, drug trafficking and financial frauds. And saying that in the recession we're seeing some new types of crime emerging, and this business trade is probably worth about $30 billion a year now.
And how is the government tackling the problem of gang crime?
Well, as I said, there's been widespread concerns about the performance of SOCA, the Serious Organised Crime Agency, and there's going to be a new department based in the Home Office to get a greater grip on what SOCA's been doing. And also, they're going to complete a network of police regional asset squads just to seize organised criminals' assets. They're going to change the law again to make it even easier, reversing the burden of proof, even easier for the police to seize the assets of these 25,000 to 30,000 people who they think are involved in the tail end of organised crime.
I mean, 30,000 people, that sounds like a lot. How does that compare to other countries?
It does sound a lot, doesn't it? I think it's kind of like an estimate of 3,000 to 4,000 gangs. About 5 years ago, when SOCA was born, politicians would talk about sort of the 100 Mr. Bigs in the country and promised to take away all their yachts, but the number of yachts in state ownership at the moment seems to be quite small still. I no longer like talking about Mr. Biggs because it makes the whole thing sound a bit silly, really, in a way. But there's obviously the networks get down to even the smallest communities.
There's also a report published by the Home Office, Alan, on immigration. What does that say?
Yes, that looks at one aspect of organised crime, people trafficking, and it's a rather dispiriting conclusion for the Home Office and the government. The researchers back in 2006 interviewed 45 convicted people traffickers in jail, and they reported that Britain was seen as a relatively easy place to get into with healthy profits and a low risk of detection. And also some of them accused the UK Border Agency of saying there were some staff willing to accept bribes, which made it easier for them to get people in. This is rather dispiriting in the nature of the scale of the problem, which has yet to get to grips with. I mean, one of the new tools that the SOCA has been given is the new emphasis on what they call the Al Capone approach. This is not giving them more Tommy guns, but having more tax inspectors going through and trying to get them on their unpaid tax rather than on their more difficult to prove financial fraud activity.
Alan Travis. Two independent schools, St Anselm's Prep School in Derbyshire and Highfield Priory in Lancashire, have been told to do more for poorer children, or they face losing their charitable status. The 2006 Charities Act requires all charities to demonstrate their public benefit. And today, the first public benefit assessments are published by the Charity Commission, which regulates charities in England and Wales. Our education editor, Polly Curtis, has the details.
The significance is that it's the first kind of real evidence of what they expect charities to do to retain their charitable status. And the bit that everyone's focused on, everyone's interested in, is private schools, because under these new laws, private schools are told that they can't restrict access to their core mission, providing education to people, because they can't afford it. And so in today's report, they looked at five private schools, and two of those were told that they weren't meeting this new public benefit test because they weren't providing enough bursaries. So although the Charity Commission says it's not just bursaries, all the indications are now for private schools that they're going to have to provide a serious chunk of bursaries to be allowed to keep their charitable status.
Now, the Independent Schools Council, which represents private schools, has said that the Charity Commission is going to force people to raise their fees and, in effect, exclude more people in order to pay for what the Charity Commission is demanding.
Well, that's right. This comes at a really bad time for private schools, who are very nervous in the credit crunch of losing pupils. And the schools that are going to come under pressure from this aren't the kind of Eton's and Manchester Grammar Schools and all the ones that people have heard of, the big ones. They're the small, often prep schools, which don't make very much money at all. And so if they're told to offer kind of, say, 5 or 10% of their fee income back in bursaries, they're going to really, really struggle to do that. So what the Independent Schools Council said today was that they're going to be forced to put up their prices, and that will penalise all the other parents who are already paying for their education and make it more unaffordable for more people, even if you're providing a few completely free.
And one of the schools that's not met the public benefit criteria that the Charity Commission has laid out is St Anselm's. It says that the school doesn't actually know what level of bursary assistance is acceptable to the Commission. So there seems to be a sort of, you know, not very clear instructions. That's what they're saying.
Well, the Charity Commission is kind of taking this approach of saying, well, we're not going to have a one-size-fits-all model. We're going to let schools kind of prove their charitable status in different ways. And that's causing a huge amount of confusion. I think what St Anselm said to me and are saying today is that they just want to know what percentage of their fee income do they have to give back. And when I put all this to Susie Leather, who's the chair of the Charity Commission, she said, well, if they look at the schools that have done well and see how much they're giving back in bursaries, that's a guide. Well, the other three schools gave back between 5 and 15% of their income in bursaries. So that is a guide. But she also insists it doesn't have to be bursaries. She says that's the easiest, clearest way to make sure that people that can't afford your fees are getting a chance to access your kind of education. But she does say that you could do it by opening up your facilities, sharing your teachers, doing all of that. But that's a lot much more complicated way of doing it.
Polly Curtis. Disabled children don't always have access to mainstream education. Nadia Clark is bright but severely disabled. She has cerebral palsy combined with deafness. She was born in Northumberland, but no school there could accommodate her. In 1998, when Nadia was six, her parents gave up their jobs and moved 100 miles to Calderdale in West Yorkshire to find their daughter a place in a school alongside her brothers and sisters. And her achievements since then have been remarkable, as Martin Wainwright reports.
I'm in Halifax with Katie Clark, and she's the mum of Nadia Clark, who we'll be meeting in a minute. And this is a wonderful story. It was first in The Guardian 11 years ago, when it wasn't such a wonderful story. The Clarks at that time, the family, were living up in Northumberland. And Nadia has a lot of difficulties, physical difficulties, with both getting around and communicating, as we'll learn. But Katie and Andy, her mum and dad, were very determined that she should be educated in the mainstream system, because, as again you'll discover, there's nothing at all wrong with what goes on inside Nadia's head. And she's a very... she's done a huge number of things. Anyway, Northumberland couldn't cope with what was required to sustain Nadia in a mainstream school. And so Kate and Andy ended up in Halifax, which is run by Calderdale Education Authority. They've basically done Nadia and her mum and dad proud, and I've just come to find out a little about how things have gone off here in the last... Well, is it actually 11 years, Katie? Yes.
It's 11 years next week that we actually physically moved house from Northumberland down to Savile Park.
Did she need sort of... Or rather, put it another way, what did she need in terms of people specifically allocated to her?
We've had really good support, and I think a lot of it is making it successful is working together, because Nadia's profoundly deaf. So we've always had fantastic support and signers, because Nadia needs to her input is British Sign Language. So her learning support assistants have always had good signing skills.
And did the other children, they'd be very fascinated at primary school age, did they sort of join in and start to learn how to sign?
Well, what was wonderful about Savile Park was that they had a signing ethos. So they had other deaf children there. So it was a resource base for deaf children. So there was a very positive attitude towards signing. So there were signers in the assembly. Young people learnt sign language. So the children in Nadia's class learnt sign language.
I'm with Nadia now. And the voice you can hear in the background is Adele, who we'll be talking to as well. Adele Gneen, who's Nadia's coordinator. She has been helping Nadia through GCSEs this summer. Now, Nadia, I should ask you really, how can you remember when you first came to Savile Park Primary School, what it was like, your first day in the school with all the other children?
I feel excited.
It's very interesting what a complex procedure it is for Nadia. What's going on is Nadia's putting in her reply to my question, and then when it's all in there...
Because...
We'll get the whole sentence.
Yes, you'll get the whole sentence.
And is this a sort of a typical pace at which she would communicate?
Have. Yes, it is, definitely. When she's communicating socially, this is how she would communicate.
What?
Yes. So that's very interesting. So there's a lot of patience required from the people who Nadia's talking to.
Yes, definitely. But all of her friends know what she's like, so they just sort of hang on, and there's normally a funny joke at the end of whatever they're talking about anyway. Nadia is very much of an individual. Her personality shines through when you meet her. That's what makes it so special working with her, really.
Nadia, when you leave college, what would you like to do then?
Maybe I go uni, or I love go travel world 1 year, and I want work help with disabled people. How life dream.
That's great. So it takes us, it's interesting to hear, it takes a little bit of getting used to it, but I think you'd have picked up she'd like to go to university or maybe travel around the world for a year and then make her work working with disabled people to help them realise their life's dream.
Martin Wainwright reporting, and their full story is at guardian.co.uk/education. Adam Gabbett and Harriet Grant produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.